You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
SB Nation and Underdog Dynasty present the Underdog Podcast.
And welcome back to another edition of the Underdog Dynasty Podcast, AAC edition. My name is Dan Morrison. That is Emily Van Buskirk. How are you doing today, Emily?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm living the dream. I'm living the post-Walt Bell dream.
Oh, no. Already, you asked stuff. We couldn't even.
I had to start there because I didn't know if I'd be able to fit it in later.
Fair enough. I gave you an opening and you took it.
Oh, yeah. It is what it is. You just can't lose by two scores to Rhode Island on homecoming and get away with it. You also can't have your record your winning percentage go below Charlie Molnar, which is a very UMass line, but.
Yeah, I don't know what that means, but
I'll tell you, Charlie Molnar. Uh-huh. Charlie Molnar was the coach that UMass first hired when they first moved to FBS, and the boosters hated him, and he went 2-22 in two seasons. With the loss to Rhode Island, Walt Bell went to 2-23 over three. So, not great.
Not great.
Anyways, that's way too much UMass talk already. As a little sidetrack. We've got our Week 10 in the AAC to review, and that's really what. Should take
part. Yes.
Because I thought it was a pretty good week.
Yeah, it's funny. I went on Memphis Radio this morning and it's like the season started out with the gap between the top teams and the bottom teams being this huge chasm almost that seemed like you could never really get across it. But as the season goes on, you've got these lower teams in the conference really fighting and kind of getting in a groove. And that's what we talked about early on is that the teams that are going to be successful are the ones that take each week and learn and actually make adjustments moving forward and get better as the season progresses, as opposed to going the other direction. Yeah. So it's kind of cool to see, you know, some of these teams like Memphis and USF put up a fight in Tulsa. So it makes me realize I don't know anything at all, but it's fine.
You mentioned Memphis and going on Memphis Radio. They are, in my opinion, by far the hardest team to understand in this conference right now because they just are. Like, this is a team that does have some raw talent, but also has glaring weaknesses and, like, can't decide what they want to be.
Right.
And, I mean, you called that game.
I did. But that's mainly because it's at home and I have a lot of faith there, you know?
And that's what I was going to say is Memphis at home is such a different monster versus Memphis on the road.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Memphis on the road is the least intimidating, you know, they're a little baby kitten. At home, they're that full tiger. It's true, though.
Like,
I know. They didn't even plan that.
My dad would have been proud of that joke.
I thought so. We should start with that game, though. So SMU 25, Memphis 28. SMU, for the second week in a row, couldn't get off the ground to start the game. It took them a long time to get going. Mm-hmm. Last week against Houston, they eventually caught up, and obviously the kick return from Jones and all that shot them in the foot. They never really caught up to Memphis in this game. And, you know, Seth Hennigan was good to go after being unable to finish up, like, go full practice all week. So that was obviously a huge benefit that they didn't have to go back.
I told you he was going to go. I knew it.
And, you know, Parrish, who I think is a very talented player, he just was clearly not ready to be out there against UCF a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
Now UCF's got a much better secondary than Memphis does, but, like, you know, I think it would have been a different outcome if that was the case still. And again, it's obviously a lot more polished, a lot more refined, a lot more confident of a thrower. And, you know, they were able to take advantage of SMU just enough to get a win that they probably shouldn't have. You know what I mean?
I mean, if your freshman quarterback, who, by the way, got honor roll honors from the AAC, completes 34 of 53 passes for almost 400 yards, two touchdowns and just one interception. I feel like you deserve, again, we have the second week in a row where the quarterback on the other team is putting up better numbers than Mordecai. And Mordecai is, I think, is clearly a better quarterback than Seth Hennigan, but you cannot go back-to-back weeks of not outperforming the other quarterback when you're everything to that SMU offense.
I think Ulysses Bentley's injury that has been kind of nagging him all season at this point is really starting to catch up to SMU because Sagers is fine, but they don't have any running game to speak of really right now. So they don't have that balance to that really makes Memphis so dangerous where they can, where you have to respect the running game. You don't really have to respect it right now. And that's, to me, I mean, they had 61 rushing yards this game. Not to say Memphis did well. Memphis only had 31 rushing yards. That's its own. I've talked about that a lot, about how Memphis doesn't have its running game that made it so good under like Mike Norvell anymore. And that makes, that's one of those things that makes me nervous about Memphis. But SMU's offense has a ton of great weapons.
Yeah.
But when you're one dimensional, and that's easy enough to kind of target and stop.
Yeah. We got to shout out defensive coordinator Mike McIntyre because I love him, but also Memphis's defense showed up.
Oh yeah. Like Memphis is like a top five pass blocking team in the country. If you just go by like sacks allowed as your metric, and they gave up 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 sacks in this game, which is, you know,
it's a lot.
That's a really, really bad day at the office for a really good offensive line. So like
it is. And one of the players to recognize, Rodney Owens, defensive player of the week for the AAC. He was a key part of that defense that limited him to a season low, SMU to a season low, 323 yards. He had 6 tackles, a sack for a loss of 12 yards, which is one heck of a sack. And he made the clinching defensive play with an interception at the Memphis 26-yard line on SMU's final drive. So shout out Rodney Owens.
Yeah, 3 total turnovers from SMU. That doesn't help you in a 1-score game either. I think the credit, like you said, really does have to go to the Memphis defense for shutting down a very good offense. I think SMU's obviously stubbed its toe a little bit the past couple weeks.
That happens. It's like a little bit of quicksand when you can't get it going. But big, big congrats to Mike McIntyre because Memphis's defense needed a game like that.
I do. I don't know if you saw this reporting, but I did, that SMU currently has a contract extension in front of Sonny Dykes worth more than double what he's getting paid right now. And he's yet to sign it. And I think he should go ahead and sign that because that's not going to get better if you keep losing.
Yeah. The money that he gets at SMU is crazy.
I just think Texas Tech just filled their spot, but TCU is open. I've heard Dave Aranda's name mentioned for bigger jobs. You know, he's a very popular name. So like Baylor could open hypothetically. I think he might be trying to use those to leverage money, but maybe send them.
It really depends on what your coaching goal is, because you sit there and you look at, okay, TCU's open. Why would you not make that transition to a bigger conference in the same area? You're still recruiting. You know, it's like, it's not that big of a change for you.
Like, I don't know where his house is. He could be a suburb right in between the two. He might not have to move.
But some coaches, the more I talk to coaches, the more I realize that not everybody's goal is to coach in a huge conference. Some want just the right setup and the right situation. Oh, yeah. And I think that's what Dykes has. So why would you
not sign the extension?
Yeah, I don't know.
I think unless you're trying to leverage more money with like the threat of leaving.
Like, how much more money do you need, Sonny Dykes? You're already getting a ridiculous amount of money. Like, that's enough.
Yeah, and this would be a massive new contract
for him. It's too much. It's ridiculous.
But yeah, you know, I mean, if Dykes stays at SMU and they keep winning like this for, say, a decade more, which is obviously a huge if, because you don't know how long he stays. You don't know if he can keep it up, blah, blah, blah. You don't even know what the conference looks like in here. That's the type of career though that at SMU would be worth a statue, just fixing them after years of nothing after the death penalty, because you know, he's the first coach who's had them relevant since then, and that's, you know, I mean, to a lot of people that's a huge legacy to leave behind. So
just
a little thought if you had heard it. We're gonna be real quick with this next game. I think it's Temple 3 ECU 45, and let me tell you what. You started the show talking about how like a lot of the teams at the bottom of the conference have worked their way and made a little, they've worked their way up closer towards what you think of as a middle tier team at the start of the season. You know, Temple's not one of those teams. They've really, I hate to say a team's quit, but it looks like they've quit when they play. You know, it just looks like they're uninterested in being there. We talked the last few weeks about Temple really needs to try to start faster so that they're not immediately behind in games. It was 21-0 at halftime. They didn't get those 3 points until the fourth quarter. You know,
you just look at the numbers, and it's, I don't, you don't even have to say names, but passing 7 of 13 for 37 yards, the leading rusher, 8 carries for 54 yards. There just really isn't anything to say.
And that leading rusher, by the way, is Lynch, the backup quarterback who played a large chunk of this game, who threw 6 for 20 himself for 20 yards.
Yeah.
You know, they had 57 yards passing between two quarterbacks who threw the ball 33 times. That's terrible.
You have to look at it
and credit to ECU because they've played that full 60-minute game that I've really been asking them to play and that they've struggled to play. ECU's got such a good secondary that doesn't get talked about enough. They really do. ECU's found a running game to balance out their offense in a way they really haven't had in years and years at this point. So ECU's doing a lot of things right to be a lot better team still.
Yeah.
But Temple just walked in there and folded the second anything hit, you know what I mean? And that's what's frustrating to me right now, is it just, I use the comparison to USF a lot, and in some ways I think it might not be fair because USF is in a naturally better position just geographically speaking.
Yeah.
But these are two teams with young coaches who are in clear rebuilds because of, you know, just the roster turnover that they inherited.
Right.
In one roster, and we'll talk about them, I think that's the last game we're going to get to just in terms of when they kicked off order. But you've got one roster in USF that plays really hard every game from the word go and doesn't quit. And you've got one that comes out half asleep and gets behind and doesn't care. And I hate to say that because I know that people care on the program. I'm not saying that they like actually don't care, but that's just the feel you get watching the game where you go, I don't even want to watch this because I just know the end result. I know that they're not going to make it interesting.
Yeah, it is hard. And I think at this point, you get through the season, you go back to the drawing board, you'll be older next year. Something's got to change. And I'm afraid of what those changes are going to be.
Yeah, I know.
You know, but it is what it is for Temple.
Here's what I'll say for Temple. I don't think they can afford the Rod Carey buyout that they gave him. I think he gets one more year.
Yeah, I think he gets one more year, but I think he's going to make some changes because you have to do something.
Well, we just saw that, like in Nebraska, Scott Frost got the dreaded vote of confidence and then cleared house from his offensive staff.
It's crazy.
Dan Mullen, I think, just got strong-armed into firing Todd Grantham and their offensive line coach, whose name I'm forgetting right now.
And Jimmy Lake over at Washington tried to save face by firing some people and then ended up getting suspended anyways.
Yeah, can't hit a kid. I think Jimmy Lake's getting fired either way. I think this is the first step towards that.
But this is the thing about that, I'll say, is that people saw that incident happen. If you didn't see it, you should go watch it. Mm-hmm. Jimmy Lake, the Washington head coach, hitting a kid on the sideline with a clipboard. And a lot of people that I know that played football think, okay, he's just getting tough with him. He's getting in his face. Okay, I'm not going to argue with that because I didn't play football. I don't like how it looks. The optics are not great. But what people need to understand is with Jimmy Lake, it's a bigger problem. This is just something that's finally coming out to the public. But I've been saying this all season long. He is not who he purported himself to be. The staff and the players did not buy in, and they did not buy his shtick. Mm-hmm. And mind you, he retained Peterson's entire staff, but came in and tried to do something completely different with the same pieces. It was never going to work.
Yeah.
He's not the guy. So now I'm glad that everybody's able to see it now, you know?
And, yeah. I hate to get too sidetracked into that, but Washington they're the most recent Pac-12 team to make the playoff. That was a team that had a really good chance to 2016.
Yeah. That's like, so long ago.
Yeah.
But that bums me out.
There's only two Pac-12 teams that have ever made the playoff.
I know
Oregon
that.
In the first year, then
I know
Washington that. In 2016. And like Washington had a lot of pieces in place where they looked like they were so close to being that like Pac-12 contender, where like if you had Washington and Oregon battling for the North every year, maybe you don't need USC to make that conference a lot more fun and relevant, but they haven't held up their end of the bargain. This is the long and short way of running in there. And it's a shame because I really like watching Washington when they're good because it's a gorgeous stadium and it's just like
it's so fun. It's fun for football. You know,
I think it's a really, really good fan base, blah, blah, blah. not to get too sidetracked out.
Anyways, yeah, sorry.
But,
yeah,
but it's a shame. Yeah. And Jimmy Lake's definitely gone at the end of the year.
I got to give a shout out to your boy, Holt Nailers, putting together a game despite Dan not, you know, being, I think you're on his team now, but
I've always said he's got a lot of potential. I don't like how inconsistent he is. And I think that he hasn't over the course of his 4 years now at ECU developed as well as he should have.
Yeah.
You know, I think you'll see in some games, he'll get happy feet in the pocket. In some games, mm-hmm. he'll make decisions that senior quarterbacks shouldn't be making, like throwing the ball once you've crossed the line of scrimmage.
Right.
And I really like his natural ability. I like his talent level. It just doesn't always put together. So yes, my boy Holton Ehlers, continue.
I think he's doing these things to spite you. I would like to see him have a game where he makes zero mistake. No interceptions would be nice. Because we seem to always have one. He did have one in this game. We seem to always have one or two. But he completed 16 of 24 for 191 yards, three touchdowns, and a rushing touchdown himself. So that earned him honors for the AAC.
The rushing thing to me is important to his game. He's a very good, strong athlete. And he's a good runner. I don't think that ECU uses him as a runner enough. If they had him just do read option 2-3 times a game, it would put teams on their heels a little bit when he's out there. Especially like 3rd-and-1 for quarterback power, that type of thing. It'd be very effective at that if they used him in that way more. Also Keaton Mitchell, they really have found a running back. He had 146 and 2 scores.
All around good for ECU, tough for Temple and not in the way that they want to be tough. Moving on.
Yeah. Navy 6, Notre Dame 34. It wasn't, it wasn't that big a blowout. It really wasn't.
Well, the score doesn't make it seem that way.
Well, this is often how the score works on the Notre Dame Navy game is where just talent overtime works out that way. Ty Labate, the Navy starting quarterback, got injured and was in a sling for the second half. That was a large part of what happened there.
Okay. So that's, he was finally getting them going in a rhythm. I felt like he was cooking. That sucks.
It was. He took a tough hit on when he was running the option. Navy did a very good job making Jack Cohn, Notre Dame starting quarterback, uncomfortable in the pocket. Jack Cohn makes himself uncomfortable in the pocket enough, but like Navy did a good job, especially in the first half, creating pressure. They got to him more often than I think North Carolina and USC did, like combined. The trick of it though is that just the talent on Notre Dame overtime just overwhelms Navy, and this happens a lot of times in the game. Like there was like a 70-yard touchdown pass to Kevin Austin where it was really not, it shouldn't have gone for 70 yards, but one guy, the corner, missed a tackle and he just had so much speed that no one on Navy could catch him. And that's kind of this thing that, that gets going. Kyron Williams from Notre Dame, who is an All-American caliber halfback. He had 2 scores. Like these things add up over time. Notre Dame's defense is incredibly talented. Their front 7 is loaded with NFL talent. And, sometimes you just can't go in, especially once your backup quarterback's in the game. And it's tough. Kyle Hamilton missed the game, but Notre Dame didn't need a safety in this game. They just needed to win the line of scrimmage. I think Isaiah Foskey missed this game too, and he's like an All-American defensive end. But guys like Jordan Botello, Kurt Heinisch, they dominated for the Irish, which I've said before. I'll say that's what's supposed to happen in this game.
Well, it did. I my only caveat here, I did not get to see the game, but looking at the box score, I would have liked to see more, always more Michael Mayer. I would like to see.
Navy took him away pretty well.
Yeah, that's what it seems like. He only had 4 catches for 28 yards. Mm-hmm. And he's, arguably one of the best tight ends in the country, I think.
In my opinion, I'm obviously a little biased about the Notre Dame thing, but I think he is the best tight end in the country. I'd put a period on it.
I can't say that because the numbers and I think that's a reflection of the talent that they play.
I think it's a reflection of the wide receivers on the outside at Notre Dame. I think right now Notre Dame doesn't, Kevin Austin's a very good wide receiver, but this is his first year at that kind of level. Right. But after Kevin Austin, what wide receiver is there on the outside for Notre Dame that you say, ooh, that's a scary guy. Avery Davis, who tore his ACL, unfortunately, in this game for Notre Dame. Ooh. He's okay, but he's never going to be a guy you need to focus on. Braden Lindsay has never come around. He's been a disappointment for his entire career. That's freshman right now for Notre Dame. So teams really can double and triple team Mayer all game long. I think that's more where you see his numbers drop off over the course of the season, as teams realize, hey, we really should just focus and take him away and make the wide receivers beat us. And, you know, that's where they're at. I also think that Jack Cohn doesn't do a great job getting off his first read. So that's just me.
Well, they took care of business Saturday, so good for them.
They did. Notre Dame's going to win out, probably be 11-1 and look really good on Cincinnati's resume.
Yeah.
Play in the Orange Bowl or something fun like that. Anyway, speaking of Cincinnati, Tulsa 20, Cincinnati 28. Davis Sprin, what are you doing?
You literally couldn't wait.
I couldn't.
First thing.
So, yeah, I'll just run through it in case anyone didn't catch the ending of the Tulsa-Cincinnati game. Cincinnati let Tulsa hang around to the point where it's an 8-point game, you know.
Could have tied it.
Yeah. And, you know, so Tulsa's driving down. They get it inside the 5-yard line, and Cincinnati gets a goal line stand. Good for Cincinnati. That's what their defense does, you know.
That's what you should be doing against a Tulsa team that is like
exactly
this.
Their defense is very good.
Good Lord.
So there's like a minute and change left. And on the very first play, because they're so backed up, Cincinnati says, we're going to do a quarterback sneak because, you know, get some room to operate with out of the shadow of your goal line. It's a pretty standard procedure from that spot. Desmond Ridder fumbles the snap. Cincinnati had a series of issues with the center quarterback exchange, mostly on shotgun, but this was under center. They fumble the snap. Tulsa gets it back. They get stopped a couple times. Davis Sprin has a chance to score on a quarterback, like a keeper, and he slides on the 1/2-yard line and gets spotted short.
The sad thing is he thought he was in. Like, heartbreaking to watch because
I think he thought he was diving in, but he slid in, which means the second you slide, it's where you start the slide, and not where you finish.
And I know the smart part of his brain knew that, but his emotion and his heart, he was like, I'm in. And he was so excited.
Just one more step. He needed to take one more step, and he had it. At that point, Tulsa should have been, you know, running a 2-point play to tie the game,
force overtime, the game.
And ruin game day for Cincinnati. And, you know, the next play, I think it was Prince fumbled into the end zone for Tulsa. Didn't really matter because unless he recovered it, it comes out anyways in that situation.
Steven Anderson fumbled. Reaching for the goal line. If you watch that, it's almost as painful as the Brin slide. I mean, they were both just painful to watch.
The Brin slide was worse for me because he was in and like, you know,
he had the lane.
Was fourth down and he was trying to get his, you know, just needed to bury his way in and couldn't do it, you know. I didn't love the play calling in that set of like, we're just going to keep running the ball. Like, just throw it. Like, Cincinnati was selling out to stop the run up the middle. Just like a little bootleg, a little something, not a jump ball 50-50 style, but like do something other than up the middle.
Yeah. This just goes to prove exactly what I've been saying about Cincinnati. You cannot be playing teams like this close at home. That's supposed to be your environment where you're bringing the pain. And Tulsa is not a good team at the end of the day. They may have played well.
They've fallen down to 3-6 now. And, you know,
you can't be doing that at Cincinnati. And this is why they do not belong in the college football playoff, because they can't even blow out teams like Tulane, Tulsa. Like, no, they don't have that killer instinct. They cannot put their knee on the neck.
I have a firm belief that if there are four teams that are 12-0 at the end of the year, then there's four teams who should be in the playoff. You know, just like that's to me, if you're undefeated, that should mean something. Like when UTSA came out, was unranked last week. That made no sense to me. I get they're in Conference USA. I get Conference USA is a mess right now, but they're unbeaten in a good team. You know what I mean? Like you just need to respect the unbeaten record to a certain extent to me, but I know, but
I don't
here's what
love
I'll
say. That. I don't well, love that, that.
That's my personal feeling about unbeaten.
I got
something. But we also know how reality works, and in a few hours, we'll get the next round of playoff rankings, and you can guarantee Cincinnati is no higher than they were last week. If they didn't go down,
they're going to stay at 6 because they did not.
If they don't go down, continue. Like in this,
I think they stay where they are. I just think they get jumped.
I mean, let's see who's behind the Michigans with 7, right?
Yeah, but I think Oklahoma has a.
I mean, Wake Forest lost, so Notre Dame.
Yeah, so they're gonna. Yeah,
they'll drop down. And yeah, it was 7 Michigan, Oklahoma 8, Wake Forest 9, Notre Dame 10. I think Oklahoma after the Baylor game. Well, if they beat Baylor, that's when they'll get their jump.
Maybe, yeah.
Here's
but I don't think Cincinnati goes up to 5. That's what everybody's asking.
I guarantee you they don't.
They don't.
They'll need Ohio State, like Ohio State, Michigan State, Michigan, probably Oregon and Oklahoma to all lose if they have any shot at it. And that's just, and when I say lose, I mean lose again. In some cases, Alabama will need to lose again.
Mm-hmm. They almost did. That was wild. And how fitting for Ed Orgeron. Let me ask you this. If he beats Alabama in that game, does LSU rehire him back? Because
They can't.
But wouldn't that be hilarious?
It would, but there's...
You went and did the one thing we needed you to do after we fired you.
There's too much fundamentally wrong with that program right now to bring him back. That's fair. Like, you can't. But,
but you got to ask that question because, like, everybody's goal is to beat Alabama. And if you do right after you're fired, your value goes up.
Oh, yeah. Alabama's also not a lot of teams are not as good as I think we think they are. But I guess my thing with Cincinnati in the playoff is if you want to get real consideration, you need to make it so that they don't have the opportunity to ignore you. And Cincinnati for 3 weeks in a row now has they've given excuses to be ignored. And I think it does come down to their offense is not capable of consistently blowing people out. Like, it makes me think more and more that blowing out UCF was a fluke. You know what I mean? Because like they blew out UCF. They blew. And ever since then, UCF has allowed 8 points a game. And, you know, their offense is what their offense is with a true freshman quarterback right now. But, you know, Cincinnati, I don't think should have been able to move the ball on UCF like that, other than something just clicked right for Cincinnati. And I don't know what it was, if they just were able to get up and say, all right, we're taking on this logo. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, oh, they're going to the Big 12 with us. Oh, they were, you know.
I think it's personal because, and everybody has that target on UCF because of their like swagger and their, their like, personality. I think people like,
and then you can't bother to wake up for Tulsa or Tulane.
Yeah. I'm telling you, and this is what I've been saying all along. I'm sorry, Cincinnati fans. I'm sure you're a very nice group of people. I mean, and
they,
I wish you,
they put chili on pasta. That's okay.
I wish them all the best. The Cincinnati fans we met at Notre Dame did not know what a Bearcat was, just for the record.
I don't think it's a real thing.
Well, they didn't know what it was, and they were Cincinnati fans.
So. I was gonna say, I'm pretty confident it's not a real thing.
But I just got to say, like, I have been riding this train from day one, and you know that I've been staunch in this. I do not think they're as good as everyone thinks they are.
No,
and having seen them play in person, even in the Notre Dame game where they played decent, they are not that good. They get lucky, and they have a lot of energy, and they run around and do a lot of things, so it looks like they're really good.
I think their defense is that good. I think their offense is not. And I think that's, you know, you need to have a full, you need to have a fully rounded team. I hate to go after Desmond Ridder because I think he runs that offense very well and he knows what he's doing, but he doesn't have the capability to be an explosive playmaker on offense. And they don't have the receivers on the outside. They've got some very good talent on the outside, but they don't have that explosiveness that like makes you go, oh, wow, look at that offense. Like if you compare, look at all like the G5 teams in recent history that have been truly threatened and made people pay attention to them. Like the 2017-18 UCF that had Mackenzie Milton on it. Houston right before that had Greg Ward as their quarterback. You know, going back a little further to the Boise State teams with Kellen Moore or even Hawaii with Colt Brennan. Like these teams had quarterbacks that made you go, wow, look at them doing something that I didn't think a quarterback could necessarily do. Desmond Ridder doesn't make you think that. You go, oh, he's a pretty athletic quarterback who makes the right read every time, but he doesn't strike fear in you if you've got corners that can lock down in coverage. He just doesn't.
And now that you've seen them play these games against Tulane and Tulsa, like there's no fear at all. I think the rest of the AAC down Cincinnati stretch is like, okay, if we at least show, I mean, if I'm SMU, I'm showing up. You got at USF, SMU, and then at ECU. And that game,
I think that ECU game going back to before you were the co-host of the show, and when it was Joe Brobeck, he would joke at me that ECU is going to be the one who beats them this year, and I was pretty dismissive about it because, you know, because
of just that sounds like something I would say. I like that,
but like
I'm with that
because he would point out that like historically Holton Ahlers would have a random 500 yard passing game, so why not make it that week?
Why not? Where
they're like looking forward to the AAC championship,
and they get them at home. They're obviously more dangerous at home in that environment.
And, you know, that's something I was dismissive towards, but, you know, the more, the closer we get to it, the better ECU's playing and the worse Cincinnati's playing, you're going, wait a minute, maybe.
The end of this American Conference this year is about to be a wild one. Like, I can't wait.
Yeah, exactly. Let's move on to Tulane 10, UCF.
I don't even want to talk about this game.
You know, Gus Malzahn broke his leg in this game and coached the rest of it standing up on a broken leg.
No.
Yeah, and on the first defensive drive of the game, UCF got a fourth down stop, and he like jumped up as a player was running over, and he fell awkwardly, and he broke his tibia, I want to say it was. And he had like the rest of the game, he had like GAs like holding him up while he was like calling plays and stuff like that. And then he showed up the next day on crutches. He's on crutches for 6 weeks.
That's wild. That's crazy, because that's the same injury I found out that Tanner McKee, the quarterback from Stanford, has.
Hey, small world.
So, but 6 weeks is the norm for that healing. Yeah. And David Shaw tried to tell us after the game that we were going to see him back this season. And I was like, I don't think you know how long the rest of the season is.
Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. Gus is in his 50s and Tanner McKee's, you know, still
but a broken bone heals the same amount of time.
Yeah, but a broken bone is a broken bone, and you need to figure that.
That's crazy. Good for Gus. Good for Gus. I mean, not good that he broke his leg, but good for him that he
literally stood on it for the rest of the game. Well, he calls plays for UCF too. So I think there's a few UCF fans complaining about play calling. Maybe he's got an excuse. He was a little distracted.
Probably didn't even register the pain, but that's a good example to set for your guys of toughness. Like, you know, good for him.
I also don't agree with the criticism about his play calling. I think I might have a slight scheme criticism when he goes to Joey Gatewood, because I think that takes Mikey Keene out of a rhythm that he's trying to get into during the game. And we saw that in the second quarter against Tulane here, where it felt like Keene got into a rhythm, then Gatewood got some snaps, and that rhythm was lost for an extended period of time. I think right now, with Jalen Robinson being banged up and a freshman quarterback, it's a little predictable that pass plays are going to Ryan O'Keefe. I think those are fair criticisms, but I don't think the play calling is the actual issue. I think a lot of it comes back to, hey, your all-conference quarterback has a broken collarbone, and like you're playing a true freshman instead, and it's just not fluid with him all the time on offense. And credit to Tulane, because their defense was awful this season. In the past 2 weeks against Cincinnati and UCF, they've stepped up and played very well, you know?
Yeah.
And you're seeing flashes of Tulane improving, but man, that UCF defense has been so good. They're allowing 8 points per game in their last three games, which is the best three game stretch since 2014 for UCF.
Wow.
Which is like, it's not what we're used to. It's a complete kind of flip the script of what UCF had been the past few years, you know?
Yeah.
And then my other thing that I'd like to point out, that was the worst 2 minute drive by Tulane in a long time for me that I've seen. And like, a little bit over a minute, they got off two, maybe three snaps. It was really bad.
Yeah. That's tough.
And they had a legit shot, because they were on UCF side of the 50, and then it was Pratt took a sack, then they threw and completed a pass inbounds. And then like with 1 second left, they got a snap off and threw a bad Hail Mary. It was incredible how long in a hurry up offense it was taking them to get snaps off. It was like they hadn't practiced it. And that's an issue in its own right. But I guess my thing is,
I don't have anything to say about it, because Tulane scored 10 points and they're 1-8. So I don't.
I mean, Pratt didn't make any.
He didn't make any mistakes.
Well, he made some mistakes. He held the ball too long a couple times. He did try to do more than he should with that times. Nothing resulted in turnovers and like disastrous turnovers like that. But it's, I think part of that, you do have to give credit. UCF secondary was a very maligned last season at times, and the start of this season, for being just not good, but it was a very young secondary, very naturally talented. They're growing a lot. And, you know, that's, you know, like I said, three straight weeks ever since the Cincinnati game, when it's been impossible to throw on them and it's been difficult to run on them, and the pass rush is getting there all day long. So I think that's worth giving a lot of credit towards, you know?
Yeah. I will give Tajay Spears a round of applause for him. He continues to have decent games despite Tulane struggling. So he's a very talented back, and he had, you know, their only touchdown. So there you go. You got to give a shout out to UCF senior linebacker Bryson Armstrong, team high 11 tackles with a sack and two tackles for a loss.
The Kennesaw State transfer.
Yeah, we love that. Honor roll AAC award winner, Bryson Armstrong. So congratulations, Bryson. They have.
All right. We've got one more game to get through now. And this was, I think, you know, maybe you say Tulsa Cincinnati was the game of the week. Maybe you say SMU Memphis was.
SMU Memphis for me, but
I was going to say for my money, this was the game of the week.
Houston, South Florida. Okay.
Yeah. Houston 54, South Florida 42, with South Florida having a legitimate chance to win this game, like late in the game. You know, that wasn't like a 42 or, you know, sometimes it gets to be like 54 to like 35. And you're like, okay, this game's over. And you take it. Then there's a touchdown or two to make it look closer. This was USF had a real shot to win this game late.
Yeah.
And to the point I was making earlier when we were talking about Temple, that's what I think if you're a USF fan this year, you're going to see the record at the end of the year probably be 2-10 or 3-9, somewhere like that. You know what I mean? Without glancing ahead at the full schedule. And you're going to go, man, it was another really terrible year where we didn't win much, but that's not what you need to look at or focus on. It's the reading in between the lines and seeing the growth of the team over the course of the season, because you found your quarterback of the future. You found some great running backs, and you know, you figured out a lot of identity to your offense at the very least. You know, there's a lot of you that's still very raw and, you know, struggles at times, especially on the defensive side of the ball, but there's also no real quit to it. And you can say, hey, we were this, but you know, we were better than we were the year before, and we can expect to be better the year after this. And I think that's really something to hold on to if you're them, you know?
Yeah.
And this game itself, like, I mean, the first play of the game was the USF kick return for touchdown. It was immediately you're like, oh boy, here we go. Like, USF's here for the day. You know?
I don't know. This is my thing. Houston had been on such a little rise there, but we've talked about South Florida being that scrappy, you know, fighter, and that's what they did. But Houston had no business defensively for what they're supposed to be in the third ward and all that talk about their, like, they had no business letting South Florida be in this game like that.
That's completely fair, because I've been saying all year that the strength of Houston is their defense.
Right.
Which, like, you don't really think about, but it's a ton of great athletes on that side of the ball, especially on the defensive line. Plus you got, you know, Marcus Jones in the secondary, and it just clicks and flows very well, that defense. And they do a great job. They did not do a great job in this game, frankly. You're right about that. You know what I mean? You know, and their, you know, their offense propped them up with a massive game. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, they had a massive day running the ball. You know, Clayton Tune was almost perfect in this game. And those were the
Clayton Tune, that looked like the guy that I talked about in the beginning, where I was like, this is Clayton Tune's year. And you were like, no. And then it wasn't.
Yeah. I mean, well, the thing with Clayton Tune that I've seen for, this is like his third year as a starter there now. He's so consistently the guy who flashes this potential where you go, man, Clayton Tune, if you just put together, and he often doesn't. He really put it all together.
You're like, if he could just, and then
For a couple of years there was, if he could just, instead of throwing the ball into coverage when he felt pressure, just throw it away or take the sack.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? If you could,
just, I feel like he's getting, and then this, he's getting there.
He is on his way.
He earned offensive player of the week honors
for
his performance in this game. Yeah. And you have to give it to him, because 21 of 26, he only missed four passes at 80.7% completion, 385 yards, three touchdowns. But not only that, he connected on 16 of his last 17 passes. They finished with a season high 646 yards without any turnovers. And it was his second consecutive game with 300 passing yards. He has also thrown 133 consecutive passes without an interception. So it's weird. If you
fixed the turnover bug in a lot of ways. You know?
Yes, he has. And it's like his ability to be so accurate, if you combined it, like, if we pieced together a quarterback from the AAC and we took little pieces of Ehlers, of Mordecai, of Hennigan and Tune, and you put them all together, you'd have this like
Dylan unstoppable Gabriel kind of quarterback.
Yeah. It'd be crazy. And Tune is a big part of that, because his percent, like his accuracy is so impressive, you know, but you're right. His decision-making, it offsets it. It's a problem.
Can I tell you what Tune did this year in a lot of ways? Is he's taken the step forward over the course of the season that you wish Michael Pratt did.
Mm-hmm.
Is Michael Pratt
more talented than Pratt? But yes,
he's more experienced than Pratt for sure. Yes. Too. It's part of it. But like, you know,
Pratt, I think he's a better passer. Like overall, I think he's a better passer. I think Pratt is more athletic and a little more like dangerous.
Yeah. Well, I think they remind me of each other a lot and how they play the game. I think they're both good runners when they, you know, need to be. They're not, but they're not a run first quarterback. They both have had throughout their careers issues with turnovers and forcing the ball too much. I think Toon's managed to clean that up. And if he can play games like this, where he also is wicked efficient and, you know, wicked dangerous downfield. He was really dangerous throwing downfield against SMU too, and give him credit for that. Then he's become this complete full package thing. And right now, if Houston, Cincinnati played next week, I'd say Houston beats them. Don't you think right now?
Yeah. I would think that would be a game I would pay to go see.
I mean, Houston has to want that second half against Tech back so bad. Because they are.
If you look at that game, that's crazy. I know that game, and that's what kind of set the tone for us. We're like, oh, this isn't the real deal for them this year.
And that's the thing is, I had, you know, the first 2 years of Dana were so weird and disappointing.
Yeah.
And Houston, where you kind of go, I came in with very tempered expectations. Then they lost to Texas Tech. Then they went to this string of games against competition that I hate to say I don't respect it, but it's just not the level of what the American puts forward with like a Grambling at the FCS level or a Rice. You know, they're the bottom of Conference USA, frankly, right now. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
you know, those games, you know, and they had Navy, who at the time was really bad. And still, if you look at Navy's record, is not a good record. You know, they had Tulane pretty early this season. You kind of keep going like, well, I'm waiting for it. And, you know, it's time to just say, yeah, they're very good. And it's a shame they couldn't have that one back. But I do think you, like I said, I don't want to get away from giving USF a lot of credit for how hard they played.
Yeah.
I mean, Houston beat them in every kind of like statistical category. As you go down the line, and the two interceptions by Timmy McLean are probably the difference overall. But, you know, USF did a lot of little things right. They didn't let Houston sack them, for one.
Yeah.
That's not easy to do. It just isn't. Like I said, this is a Cougars team that gets after you know.
Yeah. And I got to shout out their special teams, because that to me was really what kind of kept them in the game as well. Yep. And Brian Batty, freshman running back, South Florida, he is the special teams player of the week. Mm-hmm. He scored 2 touchdowns on kickoff returns, becoming the second player in NCAA FBS history to register 2 100-yard kickoff returns in the game. He also had a 29-yard rushing touchdown, which gave them a lead on both of his returns. He joined former USF wide receiver Terrence Horn as the only AAC conference player to register 2 touchdowns on kickoff returns in a game. And he's the NCAA leader with 3 touchdowns on kickoff returns this season. So I really think Houston dropped the ball in the special teams area. That's clearly a weakness for them. And that South Florida exposed that, but you got to love the fight. Like Jeff Scott's like, I'm going to get points wherever I can. Mm-hmm. And I love that about him. So.
Oh, absolutely. And Houston, by the way, next week, they're at Temple.
Ooh.
Yeah.
It's going
to be bad. It's going to be bad.
They're going to take out all that frustration from this game on Temple. I'll tell you that much.
Yeah, no, it's Temple, Memphis, and UConn coming up for Houston. So I think they probably flex a little bit there. I mean, Memphis, obviously, I mean, the Memphis-Houston game's at Houston, so they should be fine.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think they're going to, I mean, with SMU losing again in conference, they're going to walk to the conference championship game now. I mean, they'd have to lose to both Temple and Memphis, and SMU would have, no, I don't think it's even possible at this point, unless like UCF somehow got in ahead of them with the tiebreaker. I'm in my head too much. We're trying to figure out how anyone but Houston could be playing Cincinnati at the end of the year.
Yeah. We can do that on the next podcast.
Yeah. Yeah, I can actually do the math out before.
Yeah, I'll let you work it out. I can see your brain working. It's like that.
Well, I'm just trying to go through like what the tiebreakers would be, because even if Houston lost twice and SMU won out, they still hold the tiebreaker on SMU. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, UCF only has 2 conference losses so far, though.
Dan's over here scheming how to get UCF.
I really am.
I can see it.
By then, Dylan Gabriel would be healthy and his head has come down a bit. So,
can you imagine what a comeback that would be? Gusmelson breaks his leg on the journey to the best comeback, and then Gabriel comes back like that.
I will be interested to see where Gus is coaching from, if he goes up to the booth to call plays from, or if he's still on the sideline on crutches going forward.
He strikes me as a sideline guy. Yeah, he strikes me as a sideline guy.
I mean, I remember when Charlie Weiss, when he was coaching at Notre Dame, he had a player kind of rolled up on him and he messed up his knee real bad. And from the Hawaii Bowl, he coached from the booth, and that was one of the silliest sights you'll ever see.
Well, my concern, I guess, for the crutches is how much of a liability that is just to be on the sideline with crutches as far as, you know, getting in the way of other players or coaches. I don't know.
Yeah.
He might want to be down there, but they may not.
You often see players on crutches, you know, on the sideline.
Yeah, but he's a coach. Yeah, he's like, I don't know.
I like to think people can see where the crutches are and run around them.
You'd be surprised when things are like, sometimes when plays come over there quickly or something's happening, it might be more trouble than it's worth. And they might tell him that, you know, like, hey, it's just better until you're more mobile. So we'll see. Let's keep our eye on Gus Malzahn on watch. You know,
I mean, I obviously mentioned he calls plays, but there's a ton more that you do as the head coach than that. That really helps to be on the sideline for, like, an easy one's working the refs. You know what I mean? You want to be the one who's in their ear talking to them all game, you know, making sure that the players that you want in the game at a given time are there. You know, a lot of times coordinators have a lot of say in that, but you know, sometimes the coach likes to overrule it if they see something. Calling timeouts and managing the clock at the end of the game, especially with a freshman quarterback, all these things are important. So we'll see. Anyways, that covers all of our teams that we have to review. Do you have anything else burning inside that you want to get out?
No, that's it. Just that I went a perfect 6-0 this week.
That's right. I did go 5-1 because I thought SMU would take care of business.
Edging my way one game at a time.
Yeah, I thought SMU would take care of business. They did not. Other than that, we were perfect together on that. I'm 57-21 overall. You're 47-31. So with 3 weeks plus conference championships plus Army-Navy, throw it out, plus bowls. You've got to make up 10 games.
Got to make up 10 games. It's not impossible. It's a little improbable the way picks sometimes. But
the thing is, we're so deep into the season now too that, like, I think we have a good idea of what teams should do what in every game. You know what I mean? Like in September, you can kind of say like, ooh, I really trust that, you know, this team will have taken a step forward and maybe they didn't, or, you know, vice versa. By November, you kind of know who every team is. So, you know, like, hey, if I'm picking this team, it's kind of a bet and a gamble. And you can only do that so often.
Yeah.
If you're trying to get them right, at least.
Exactly. Sometimes I just blow it up. I don't know. We'll see.
You can take Temple next week if you want. I won't stop you.
No, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do that. I'm not crazy.
Hey, it's all good. You can find me at Dan_Morrison96 on Twitter.
You can find me at MLNEM, EMILNEM on Twitter and Instagram.
All right. And I think that'll do it for this week.
Perfect.